Weekend with Jenna Ellis. This is our AFR exclusive podcast and the show where we answer your questions on demand. And we've gotten a lot of listener response to the interviews that I've done with several people, but most importantly, and I think most intentionally, Ken Cuccinelli, when we're talking about the subject of immigration. And I've had a variety of listeners asking for him to come on the podcast and talk a little bit more in depth about what the Trump administration actually can do in terms of mass deportations, in terms of actually getting Congress to do their job, in terms of a uniform rule of immigration and naturalization, and also what happens, you know, if Tom Homan, the border czar, is in conflict with, say, the Denver mayor, who says, you know, hey, I want to have a sanctuary city, and I don't care, I'm willing to go to jail, and Tom Homan says, well, hey, we agree on that, I'm willing to put you there. What actually happens when there's a conflict between the state and federal government on the issue of deportation of illegal immigrants. So Ken Cuccinelli, who is a senior fellow for Immigration and Homeland Security at the Center for Renewing America and also previously served in the Trump administration, was very kind to join us for this long-form conversation. So Ken, why don't you just kind of give us an overview first of kind of where we're sitting at this moment when Trump is promising things like mass deportations. What are the mechanics around this?
Well, we're sitting in a deep hole, which is a big part of why he won again. I would say that we can get to the mechanics. It's important for people to believe, to understand. I'm going to share a lesson from a history class I took, and that is this lesson. The perception of power is as important as the power itself. And what that means is you can have the strongest military in the world, but if nobody believes that you will use it, you may be able to beat people, but you won't be able to deter them. And because they don't believe the power is as strong as it actually is. So let's take that to the border now. We're already seeing Mexico change its behavior because Donald Trump won the election. They believe Donald Trump will do what Donald Trump said he's going to do. We are seeing drops in numbers of caravans, for example. People are beginning to struggle with the notion of coming. Now, we could also see a dash to the border, but we saw this at the beginning of Trump 1, where without the president doing a single thing in January of 2017, if you go back and look at the border apprehension numbers, they were phenomenally low in 2017. Why was that? Because people around the world believed Donald Trump when he said, I am going to keep you out and I'm going to do the best I can to do that. Now, I don't think he did the best he could to do that. I asked him to use the military on the border, and he wouldn't do that. But now he's committed to it. Now he's committed to it. And I fully expect that you will see that kind of response around the world. Now, we're also seeing the response here domestically. And, of course, I'm answering your question, Jenna, with a before he has power answer first.
Right.
Because we do have this two-month interim. You know, we've got 7 weeks left in it or so until he is sworn back in again. And we're having mayors and governors, J.B. Pritzker, you want to come for my people, you have to go through me. Oh, big, tough, rich guy. Okay, as Tom Homan said, we accept. We'll go through you. And normally, when states disagree with an aggressive immigration policy, the response is simply not to participate in it. It's passive resistance. But the phrasing of the Denver mayor, we're going to have our Tiananmen Square moment, and of J.B. Pritzker, you'll have to go through me. These are very actively phrased threats, like he's going to himself, or more likely, as cowardly bullies do, order other people to stand in the way of federal law enforcement officers. And if they do that, they will be committing a felony. Every police officer, every mayor, Governor Pritzker. And that's why Tom Homan says, I'm happy to arrest you. Go ahead, stand in the way, and we will arrest you for harboring illegal aliens. We'll arrest you for conspiracy to harbor illegal aliens. If you stand in the path of a federal official, we will arrest you for resisting federal officials in the course of their work. It's sort of the non-contact version of resisting arrest. All of those are felonies. They're all federal felonies. And that's why Tom Homan says, we're happy to arrest you. Because Tom Homan knows very well that he's going to arrest one of them, and it's going to stop. It's going to stop very quickly. And are they really going to order their own people into harm's way? Now, if you're a police officer in Denver, you're about to learn whether your mayor gives a flying rat's tail about you or not. Actually, I think in Denver, you already know the answer to that, unfortunately.
Part of the reason I moved to Florida. Yeah.
No, that's right. And it's not a good answer. But those are all before Trump takes office. Now, he can't arrest any of these people until he takes office. But I assume it will be an absolute precondition for anyone who's a U.S. attorney in the Trump administration the second go-round, and it wasn't in the first, that they are willing to focus time and attention on individual violators of immigration law. I'm going to be very disappointed, frankly, if that is not an absolute requirement of U.S. attorneys. But you can expect to see those enthusiastically taken up. They won't be in a jury in front of the city of Denver. It's the entire district of Denver that where the jury pool will be drawn from. And that matters in these cases.
It does.
As you know very well. And so there's going to be a little bit of that kind of legal combat. But none of that gets to actually implementing the mass deportation. And that's going to be a two-step process. The first step is the easy one. The second step will take the whole administration. The first step is securing the border, and it may surprise people to hear me say that's easy, but once you have the political will to use the military to close the border, you can close the border. It's why I asked Trump to do it in the first term, and he's now determined to do it. He ran on it. He has a mandate to do it, and that can literally be done in a matter of weeks. And what closing the border means on the southern border, it is almost 2,000 miles long, means manning the space in between the many legal ports of entry that we have on the border so that all traffic, or virtually all traffic, you never get to 0% reduction, but that all traffic of every kind has to go through legal ports of entry. So people are actually going to have to present themselves to a border agent. And I presume that if they don't have a legal basis to come in, they will be turned away. And that is what border security looks like when it's actually implemented. Now, that will create new questions and so forth. But my prediction is that all the news coverage of the border is largely going to go away by the end of March of 2025 because it's going to be boring. It's going to be pictures of a few troops looking out on a vast expanse of nothing, and it'll be boring. And that's what you want when you're in security. I used to tell my security guards at the Department of Homeland Security, I hope you have a boring day, because a boring day is a successful day in the security business. And that's true for border security as well. Then we turn to the hardest job of all, is deportation. There are going to be a lot of elements to this, including, as you noted at the beginning, elements of congressional cooperation, particularly as it relates to the budget, and I don't just mean amounts of money. So, for example, ICE will probably need to be funded at three times the level it's funded now, go from about $8 billion and some to about $25 billion, just Ken's ballpark. But you also really need the senators, and I zero in on the Senate because of the Byrd Rule, and for your listeners, the Byrd Rule, B-Y-R-D, named after Robert Byrd, is a rule that doesn't allow you to change substantive law using the budget, that the preponderance of the effect in the budget has to be monetary, not substantive. That's a little bit of an iffy thing, and I'll give you where it comes into play here. There are massive backlogs in immigration cases. And by the way, this is wildly unfair to people who play by the rules.
Isn't
the people
it always?
Who play by the rules
yep.
are being cheated. As the, I mean, it's like being in a line, and when people cut in line, what do you think? Well, this is a real. This isn't like some roller coaster where people are cutting in line. This is, where am I going to live the rest of my life cutting in line? This is a big deal, and I will tell you that, you know, I had the honor of swearing in many, many new U.S. citizens when I led the United States Citizenship and Immigration Services before I was the Deputy Secretary at DHS, the legal immigration agency. And I'll tell you what, it's very moving to swear people in. Their families are there. It's like the biggest day in their life. And people are crying. And I mean, the Americans are crying. And you know, they're particularly sensitive to cheaters. And they told me so. You know, I talked to all these folks while I was there. I didn't just show up and read an oath. And by the way, it's a very long oath. So this deportation effort, Jenna, is going to be all-encompassing. Yes, of course, they're going to prioritize criminal aliens. There's probably 500,000 or 600,000 of those. And when we say criminal aliens, what we mean are people who've committed other crimes in the United States, whether it's drunk driving or murder or anything in between. As far as I'm concerned, jaywalking is more than enough. People often talk in terms of like moral culpability. Well, we should go after the murderers first. Well, of course, we should go after the murderers first. That's just a matter of public safety. But there's another reason you grab criminal illegal aliens, and that is the simple concept that they have identified themselves to you. They have popped up on the radar. And it is very hard to find fugitives. And we've got to go find 10 million, 20 million of them. So when someone pops up on the radar, I don't care if it's for jaywalking. We should take complete advantage of that, and we should go to their house and pick up everybody else who lives there, who is here illegally, all of them at the same time, and deport them. And it is not an additional moral judgment on whatever their second crime was. And I say second crime because crossing the border illegally is a crime. So they're all criminals, except those who overstayed a visa. That's a civil offense, but they're still here illegally. And then there's another 1.3, 1.4 million who already have removal orders. They've been through the entire due process effort. And it is that due process that I think the budget can be used to shorten. I think if the Congress said, we need to save money here, and to save money, we're going to require people to appeal from any level in the immigration system to the next level above to be back in their home country and to run their appeal from their home country so that we can save money. And we would save an enormous amount of money. We would save enormous amounts of money on detention, and on deportation. It's a massive money saver. So the question will become in the U.S. Senate whether they're willing to treat that as preponderantly saving money, or are they going to rule against it, particularly the parliamentarian, and say, no, that's a change in substantive law. The courts have said that illegal aliens only get whatever due process Congress gives them. They don't get what you and I get if we're accused of a crime. And
nor should they. They're not U.S. citizens. So, I mean,
no, exactly. But right now they get more.
Right.
And that's ludicrous. It's absolutely ludicrous. And part of that is judicial intervention over the years that have just made and so forth. So so that's going to be a big, big, big decision, assuming the Senate will even take it up. You never know. But hopefully John Thune is an improvement over Mitch McConnell in this area and be willing to do these things. Let's say they are willing to do that. To use, Romney's old quip of self-deportation, we're going to find out who's serious about their case and who's just stalling, because the ones who are serious about their case are going to go home to continue the case, and the ones who are just stalling through the system are going to stay illegally. And so the next thing will happen. The next thing to happen will be the cancellation of work permits, coupled with a huge uptick in workplace enforcement by Homeland Security investigators, HSI, which is part of ICE. Many people listening to you and I may remember the summer of 2019 raid at chicken plants in Mississippi. And the only reason they may remember it is because it was the only major worksite enforcement during the entire first Trump administration. And, I mean, talk about a supposed job Americans won't do, right? Working in a chicken processing plant. They arrested like 680 illegals. And you remember the pictures of the crying children leaving school and because their parents were arrested. Let's just remember you're going to see those pictures again, folks. Just remember whose fault that is. It's the parents' fault. It's not the fault of the U.S. government. The parents made these choices. And so those folks were processed for deportation. Critically, company officials were arrested and charged. And that's gonna happen in a second Trump administration as well. And you didn't see that in the first Trump administration, except with this one different effect. And it's a pet peeve of mine, so I want to touch on this a little bit. These jobs Americans supposedly won't do, first of all, Americans did them for 100 years. That's one. Two, these chicken plants, a week later, I mean, these chicken processing plants were wiped out from a labor standpoint. They held a job fair the next week. Poor black and white Mississippians showed up from all over the place and were giving interview after interview about how happy they were to have these jobs. They were ecstatic to have the job. If you hear someone say these are jobs Americans won't do, you know that you are hearing from an elitist. You're hearing from an elitist who would never do that job. I come from Italian-Irish stock. In first generation of arrival, my family would do an awful lot of legal things. My grandfather did one illegal thing. He was a bare-knuckle boxer in speakeasies during the Prohibition, and the winner would get a watch, and he'd go pawn it. That wasn't pleasant. It also wasn't pleasant for the people fighting my grandfather. Hmm. But Americans will do the work it is necessary to carry this country forward, whether that's picking plants or processing food and so forth. We've done it for all of our history. We'll do it again. And one of the moral components to this enforcement, and Kevin Roberts has a good article on this in The Federalist recently, that this helps American poor people. The people who got those jobs in Mississippi were American citizens who are poor and want to work. That's who benefits from strong immigration enforcement. At the end of 2019, before COVID hit, Donald Trump achieved the lowest poverty rate in the history of that statistic in America. That's my whole life. We spent more time under 8% black unemployment in Trump's first term, listen closely to this, folks, than my entire life before that combined.
Wow. Wow.
That's what real immigration enforcement does, coupled with stimulating your economy. He did it with the tax cuts and cutting your economy loose by deregulating. And I fully expect to see more of that again in the second term. But for poor people, if you just literally let tens of millions of illegal people come in and undercut skillless jobs and low-skill jobs, well, who loses? High school graduate Americans, Americans who didn't graduate high school, who didn't complete college. Those are the people whose jobs that they do have, you're lowering the wages of, and that you're denying the opportunity to have a job in the first place. It's immoral. It's immoral. And it's never been talked about in moral terms. And we need to talk about it on the right in terms of morality. It is immoral to attack our poor people like an open borders policy does.
We do. And that's such a great point, because the left often talks about immigration in terms of humanitarianism and in terms of, I mean, they couch it in moral philanthropy and activism, and they want to make it seem like all of these people on the right who are for closed borders and law enforcement are somehow not caring about the poor and the destitute, and they point to, you know, the Statue of Liberty and the poem as if that's hardcore statutory law enforcement, right? Yeah, I'm sure. You know, and so you're absolutely right. And so what are the best responses in terms of the moral components of law enforcement on this issue?
So first of all, a national government's first responsibility is to the nation and its citizens. And I would suggest that there's a hierarchy there. And this is a little bit of my Catholic principle of subsidiarity coming into play here. That, yes, everyone is equal before the law, but to the extent the government engages in action, if it can only do one thing, it should protect that person who is least able to protect themselves, who is an American, and then work your way up from resources and ability from there. And this is why the emphasis on helping America's poor simply by enforcing the law has this massive moral component to it. So people who want to tell you open borders and closing the borders is immoral have it exactly backwards. The world is not, we don't have a world government. God created governments. I mean, they're in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and Jesus told us, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, but the government has a rendering to do as well. There is a role for government, and the first role is public safety of the people for whom that government is responsible. Now, I think from a Christian perspective, next would be the visiting and transient who are legitimately present, and not to abuse those who are not legitimately present. So as tough as we talk about immigration and deportation, we never forget that we're dealing with real live human beings made in the image of God, and they deserve the dignity of human beings, but they deserve that dignity while they're being processed out, because right. That is legally the appropriate thing to do. If I could rely again a little bit on my Catholic background. So in Catholicism, there's the Catechism, which is a thousands of paragraph long set of statements where our theology is applied to the world, explained and applied to the world. There's one paragraph on immigration. And that paragraph says, and I'm summarizing, of course, it says two things. One, it says rich nations should be generous to poorer nations when it comes to immigration. And I would suggest that in our legal immigration system, we are the most generous nation in the world, and among the most generous in the history of the world. We take in people from all over the world, and we always have, and we take in lots of them. And we offer safe harbor to the oppressed. That's what asylum is supposed to be for. It's for, you know, coming when you're a political prisoner in Cuba. You know, that's what asylum is for. It's from the Soviet Union, running from Putin in Russia. That's what asylum is for. It isn't some category of immigration.
Or
on the flip side, yeah. On the flip side, migrants are obligated to obey the laws and customs of the place to which they're migrating. Well, these people we're talking about have absolutely not done that. They have violated our laws and customs rather brazenly and done it with other people, the drug cartels, who are doing us regular harm in other ways, and destabilizing Mexico, by the way. And that's going to be a feature of Trump, too. He never went after the cartels in his first term. I would be very surprised if he did not become very aggressive with the cartels in his second term. And the Mexican government isn't doing that. So that is, just prepare yourself, folks. That is going to involve entering the country of Mexico periodically, probably to attack drug manufacturing sites, to attack criminal de facto governments, and also working around the world to undermine them, whether that's online or seizing materials in the air and on the ships and underwater. These people have submarines, Jenna. They have submarines. Mm. That's how rich they are. They own submarines to move drugs and people. And you're going to see aggressiveness on that front as well. And I don't know what Mexico's response will be, but I do know Mexico is not an ally of the United States. It is our neighbor, but not an ally. And many people listening can think of their own neighborhood and think, wow, I live around people like that. You know, they're not pals. You're not having them over for dessert, but you still live in the same neighborhood. So you work to get along and to be kind to one another and so forth. And we do that. And they do that, though I would suggest they do it a lot less than they should. And it's important for your listeners to understand 1/6 of Mexico is absolutely controlled by drug cartels. These are de facto governments that are criminal terrorist organizations that control 1/6 of Mexico. Another 1/6 of Mexico is contested as to control between the federal government and the state governments and the drug cartels. The Mexican government only actually controls 2/3 of Mexico. And that has been true for all of your and my life. And that's a little bit foreign for people in the United States to contemplate. But can you imagine if the American government didn't control, you know, the entire West Coast, that gangs controlled the West Coast? And we'll leave the jokes aside on that for the moment. But that it's that kind of scale. And it has always been that way in Mexico. And that's not a good thing. I believe America should make it a goal of America to get the Mexican government control of Mexico back. Well, or back would suggest they ever had it all. But you understand what I mean. Mm-hmm. That's what we're dealing with over there. We're actually not just dealing with the Mexican government. There are a bunch of other governments that we call drug cartels, but that function as governments in their areas of control. And unfortunately, the northern part of Mexico is under the control of drug cartels.
This is all just, so much more detailed and complex than what the media, especially the leftist media, would suggest, Ken. And so
shocking.
As you rightly, you know, right? Yeah, shocking that, you know, you shouldn't just believe the headlines. This is why we do these kinds of deep dives. And in just the last few minutes I have with you, and I so appreciate this, you know, just really well laid out, thorough analysis of the complexity. Do you think that Donald Trump and the people that he's appointed thus far, and obviously there's the massive bureaucracy underbelly, but then the Congress as well, do they have the political will to actually accomplish what you're suggesting that they should?
So I believe now, he didn't have it in the first term, but I believe Donald Trump has the political will now. And that is the necessary first step, is that political will. How far the House and Senate are willing to go, and I mean the House, you know, we talked about how closely divided it was before. I think it's even more closely divided now. So literally the whole GOP has to not only stick together, they actually have to show up for the votes, which sounds simple, but with 435 members, you know, there's always somebody who's got something. Oh, my mom died, I'm at the funeral. You know, there's all kinds of things. But and then over in the Senate, with a 3-vote margin, are they willing to use the budget process called the reconciliation process to advance this agenda? And that's going to be a major test of just how far President Trump can go. If the Congress isn't willing to nearly eliminate the ridiculously overborne due process that illegal aliens get so that we can move them out of the country, then this is going to be a slow plodding process. And if they are willing to do that, then you could see a real burst of movement out of the country among illegally present persons in pretty quickly. And by pretty quickly, you know, this isn't going to happen in January or February. As I noted, the border will get secured first. And the deportation process is a slow and gradual and logistically intense process that's going to ramp up. So really look for, where are they in year two? What are they positioned to do for deportation in 2026? And a complicating factor is lily-livered Republicans who say, oh, but now I'm headed to an election. Well, there's always an election.
And shouldn't an election mean...
what are they willing to do in the face of it?
Yeah, and shouldn't an election mean, what are you getting done, and what did you campaign on, and what are you doing, instead of wanting to be, you know, so non-offensive to any side? I mean, I'm tired of Republicans running on that and being so scared of an election that they don't accomplish anything in their term.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Yeah, I agree with that. And it is amazing how immune to that logic so many Republicans have been for so long. Gee, if I just don't do anything, all these other people who don't like me will like me and they'll vote for me. No, they won't.
No.
No, they won't. And
at least
your own
Trump,
people won't respect you.
At least Trump came in just as a wrecking ball in 2015 and 16, completely upending that entire narrative. But I agree with you, Ken, that he has to go even more hardcore than he did his first term. And hopefully he knows now how Washington works in some of these ways. And I think he's already shown that with some of the political calculations that he's made, even just in terms of staffing and how he ran his campaign. And so I have a lot of hope, and it'll be very interesting to see what actually gets accomplished once he gets into office, because as you mentioned at the top of the program, you know, we're in the position right now of before he actually attains power, and he's already accomplishing a lot by just people saying, being afraid of him coming back into office, which is a good thing. But once he actually gets in, so last question for you then, you know, where should we be at with the immigration process after the first, say, 100 days?
Well, after the first 100 days, the southern border should be secure. We haven't talked about the northern border, which has seen a statistically very high increase in illegal crossings. It's a much more difficult border to secure. The numbers are lower there, and there's reason to think Canada will be more cooperative. But I think at the 100-day mark, you should see the southern border secure because we've deployed military in between the legal ports of entry along with Border Patrol. And Border Patrol, of course, is going to be converted from a greeting force to a law enforcement organization overnight with the swearing in of Donald Trump. So that's the border in 100 days. But the mass deportation will only just be getting organized at 100 days. So don't expect to be seeing, you know, 60 planes a day going out at the 100-day mark. But that should pick up by the end of the calendar year 25 and into 26.
Okay. Well, and we can hope that we will at least get that far, and America will be on a much better track to tackle this entire problem that you correctly describe, you know, as a national sovereignty issue, a moral issue, and also I think is a huge part of the Trump mandate. So as this continues, Ken Cuccinelli, will be very grateful to have your analysis and expertise on this subject matter. But thank you so much for doing this deep dive. I've learned a lot through this conversation of just, you know, where all of these different tentacles, the players involved, what should happen. And so I really appreciate you coming on for this deep dive conversation here on Demand. And for listeners, if you have a comment or suggested topic, you have a question, suggested guest, you can always reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net. And we'll be back with more next week to do a deep dive here on Demand.